So welcome once more. This is our new series of classes on the tarot, which is a Western tradition, although some people might not think so, a Western meditation tradition. And it is highly respected amongst some people and highly disrespected amongst other people. It pretty well covers everything in the universe, doesn't it? I've been talking mostly about the background of it until today. So are there any points in what we've discussed so far that you want to go over again, those of you who were here before? Because today I was thinking of starting with the first card. So if you have any basic questions or anything you want to...
So the Eastern, how did you describe the Eastern as opposed to the Western?
I like the way His Holiness the Dalai Lama talked about the two. He said that in the East, basically, there was much more interest in understanding how mind works and the almost invisible qualities. In the West, the prominent Western culture, much more interested in the physical and the visible qualities. Reality in the West has more of a emphasis on the physical. When people talk about reality, they're usually talking about a physical fact, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And in the East, it tends more to be an energy or a spiritual. Reality has more to do with that. So that is not to say that at various times both traditions have not dipped into the opposite. But the overall prevalent thing is in the East there has been much more interest in trying to understand how mind works. In the West, there's, you know, the science of our day is basically trying to understand the physical laws, the laws of physical reality. So chemistry has to do with actual metals, whereas in the East, chemistry has to do with when this mind state comes up, what is the effect on the perception? When this mind state comes up, what is that effect on the perception? When something triggers a memory of something, why do you remember this rather than that? And we all know that from our own life, don't we? That when we're in some circumstances and some memory is triggered, in one mood you will remember one thing and in another mood you'll remember another. Do you all know that, or do you want me to say more about that?
No, it's okay.
About the woman behind you, is that good, or do you
want... I'm fine.
Okay. So I can't always tell whether somebody's... So I appreciate your support. So, whereas in the West we have to get a certain result from trying a test on a physical thing many times, and then that test has to be duplicated by someone else so many times, and then you have a fact. You start with a supposition, and then if it can be duplicated, it's called a fact in Western science. True? Whereas in Eastern science, it's more, you try something, it seems to be true, you check it out yourself, you see whether it holds up true in all the different states, and then you see whether that leads to a better question. And after it has led to a satisfactory result, then other people are interested in learning it. So it's a slightly different, you know, slightly different approach. One is more with the invisible and one is more with the visible. Is that good?
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
We get the little daily thing the Dalai Lama sayings. One of the things that came up about 2.5 weeks ago is the Western mind always leads to efficiency because we're so used to dealing with the material world. Because we go to the material world, we go to the efficiency. So it always goes to end result and efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
there was other things attached to that as well, but it was really interesting way of looking at the way the Western mm-hmm. mind works.
It's salt true, isn't salt. It? When we have a desire, we have a very short time before we want it fulfilled. Isn't that true? I mean, we like gratification more than we like anticipation. Don't we?
Mm-hmm.
I know it was very interesting when I had the great good fortune of working with my native teacher, Frank Lacoste. He was a beautiful, great teacher. He lived in Yukon. And the first time I spent any real time with him was at Leslie was doing he was running what they call a bear fast, which happens in the fall. Hi, dear. Happens in the fall, and what you do in the fall is that the people that are doing the fast for 3 days go without food or water in this little, very small, little like a cave. They're the bear, and it starts, they face away from the door, and they have certain prayers and rituals that they do like a couple of times, I think 4 times a day, but the rest of the time they're in there. And then on the third day, the medicine man or shaman or whatever you want to call him, Frank, my beloved teacher, would go and turn each one of them around because it was time for them to re-enter. You know, like Jesus, 3 days in the cave, only this is like a totally different but the same kind of truth involved. And then some of us were chosen to eat for them. The same thing, and send them the energy. The same thing happens at the Sundance. Some people are fasting and other people are eating for them and supporting them with energy. Interesting, huh? And when I was on that course, Frank gave me some instruction about practices that he had initiated me into, that I could do some native practices. And he would be describing something to me, and then he would fall silent for a while, telling me how to, you know, pick cedar or pick sweet grass and how to make the offerings and so forth and how to use them and stuff. And he would be silent for a while, and I would ask a question, and he would just sit there. You notice how your energy starts getting a little antsy? What if I sat here for another 5 minutes? What am I supposed to do here? Should I be thinking something? Well, I wonder if I left the stove on under the kettle. You know? And the third time I did that, he got up and walked away. For some reason, I knew better than to run after him. Because you know how much I love asking questions in the middle of one of your conversations. And then much later, he mentioned to me, when I had learned how to listen, very often he said, and you know, Native people very rarely look you in the eye. If they've been trained to work with Westerners, they'll look you in the eye. He said to me, sometimes someone has a question. So maybe they walk up to someone and ask that question. Maybe that person goes away. Sometime that person will come, maybe hours, maybe years later, and answer the question. Well, isn't that just not our culture? I don't know. I'll check it on the net. Isn't that just not our culture? Do you know what kind of respect for your own demands that would bring? That you actually had the power to ask for something and then wait and keep living your life and practicing kindness with what's around you and wait? That's a big difference, isn't it? But we don't do that, do we? I mean, that's how our culture has kept going, because we're cash cows. Have a really big desire and then buy, 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 buy. Isn't that true? And isn't it like in big and small ways just push down our throats? Isn't it? Mm-hmm. Get real. But actually take a question and honor it as worthy and put it out there and then leave it alone. Trusting. And not a question based on how do I get out of this terrible situation, but maybe what is the value of this terrible situation? Do you understand? Not about I. How do I get gratified? That's interesting. I think that's more than interesting, but I'm using that word. So that whole kind of quality of like letting go of the intellectual sense of right is very woven in there, isn't it? Do you see that? Because whenever we're going to get out of or get into, it's because we're right or we're trying to protect ourselves. Isn't that true? Mm-hmm. Trying to weave it around this way or that way. But the respect for that which is beyond self is left out, because in our culture, we expect self-gratification. That's what keeps the economy going. Economies rise, economies fall. What is more profound than economic goingness? How about who is the self? Capital S. It's called the fool card. It's called the fool card. Big picture. This is the first card of the tarot. It is also the summation of all cards of the tarot. So it's called zero, because it is all numbers and no number. It's the fool. This card represents the end and beginning of all desire. It is said in all religious teachings that are of a mystic or mystery tradition, that all desire will eventually lead you to fulfillment. The catch is, you have to go through the path that every desire takes you through in order to learn whether that's the path you want to take to fulfillment. You know? Maybe you're taking, you know, some of the paths I've tried, I'm really glad I decided not to continue on. Because I still have my memory, more or less, you know, and my health, more or less. And a real incredible group of friends, more and more. And we work together. Fantastic. Out of kindness. Incredible. That's richness, isn't it? Wouldn't you say? Whereas some of the paths that I've tried, although it got me a short-term desire, the long-term suffering was not what I desired. I know many people whose credit cards are maxed out. They wouldn't describe that as being the long-term suffering. They would say, well, how much do I have to pay down before I can spend more? Does that make sense? But from the point of view of the teaching, all desire leads to fulfillment. What they leave out, as I said before, and I will reiterate, is like you also have the intelligence to decide at any point whether this is the path you wish to take to fulfillment. And some of you, I'm sure, no doubt, have friends or siblings or children who you've watched going on a path that you don't feel comfortable about them going. And quite often you've seen them realize that themselves, right? And there is something about that that should give you more faith, not more fear. But somehow those people know their real worth and are struggling to figure out how to keep it clear. So this is the Fool card. This is the power of your being. That is not yet manifesting, but always about to fall over the cliff of manifestation. It's that part of the being before manifesting that knows the transcendent. Here on the top of his undershirt is the Hebrew list, Hebrew initials for Yahweh. Y-H-V-H. Yahweh. Which means the great I am, or Jehovah, we say. This is the at-one-ment. The knowing of the at-one-ment is the first layer of clothing. If you were going to clothe this energy, which has not yet fallen over, it represents three levels. The third level of all creation. In a lot of the tarot is Kabbalistic. Do you know what Kabbalistic means? Mm-hmm. Any of you have it? Hmm? Kabbalistic is the Judaic mystical tradition. And most of Western mystery schools are based in Kabbalistic teaching. Masons and so forth. You know that Christians are actually Jews in disguise. You know that Christ was a Jew. You know that Buddhists are actually Hindus in disguise. You know Buddha was a Hindu. And who knows where it started before then? The Fool. The Fool is where it starts before then. The Fool is the third of the three faces of the beyond words. Third of the three faces of the transcendent. They're called Ein, Ein Sof, and Ein Sof Aur. That's Kabbalistic, that's Hebrew. You don't need to go there. If you want to, you can get a book and read about it. It's in this book. Some of you have this book now. The Tarot book. Very excellent book. Paul Foster Case, one of the oldest ones written for our Westerners about the tarot, that actually has quite a lot of the mystery school and the meditations. I really like this book, which Bob lent me, as closer to how I was taught tarot by my beloved teacher, which was actually part of what that was also the movement, doing the dance of each of the cards, each of which took a day. We had to make costumes and things like that. A very profound experience, very moving in terms of the intuition suddenly coming to a new understanding. So I'm trying to like evoke some interest in the Western path, not just through the Eastern, Because I think that's useful for us to have some pride in our own heritage. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. We have a very strong heritage. To actually draw on it is useful. So with the tarot, you notice that he's about to step over the cliff, but he never actually falls. This is the cliff of manifestation. This is before manifest. Say, Ein Sof Ur is who he is, which is the third stage of Ein Sof and Ein Sof Ur. He is about to fall into manifest, about to become manifest. And so his last, his outer robe has all of these symbols of all the possibility. You could call it the entire code of all DNA of all beings throughout the multiverse. So symbols of all the possibilities of how to manifest. The inner code has Yah, Hev, Vav, Hev, just at the neckline. It's white, but it is marked with the name of Yahweh. I am that I am. So there's already an I-ish kind of quality, but no possible path. With the third coat, the possible path is there. Then the bare skin, because the bare skin is the first coat, the second coat is the white with Yahweh, and the third is the all possibility coat. And he's got this penis, see this penis, and this vagina. See the vagina? You ever seen a purse? Isn't it kind of like everything comes to birth out of it? Except the car keys you're looking for? Oh no, don't go there. He's got this penis which is holding this vagina, and there's this eyeball on the vagina, meaning all seeing, all possibility. Could give birth because of the sometimes they describe that purse as memory. Could give birth to anything. So this is the ability to give birth to all possibility. And that's white. And this is black. So what do you know about black and white? How come something is black? Why is something black to our eye?
It absorbs all color.
It absorbs all color. How come something is white?
It reflects all color.
Reflects all color. And isn't that pretty well the opposite of what you think of men? Do they absorb all colors? Hell no, they're going for that. You know, if you're going shopping with a man, can we just go to the sock department? I just want socks. They don't absorb all colors, do they? They do under protest. If they're married long enough, they do. But, like, you know, let's get real, folks. You know? Right? Men shop, women... No, men men buy, women shop. Isn't that how that goes?
Yeah.
Isn't that the way that statement goes? Men buy and women shop. Women say, I mean, I'd like to buy this, and then they're out of there. Women go, I'm like, oh, what's this? Oh, wait a minute, over here. Oh, women absorb everything. They tend to be black. And men go, they tend to go, no, this color, I reject all the rest. And they reflect the color that they're, right? Is that clear? Mm-hmm. So you can see that there is like really some behind this symbolism. There is much more, if you pay attention to your senses, much more an energy teaching going on here. So the penis is black, meaning not only am I pointed, but I'm absorbing. Oh, what a concept. And the vagina is white. Not only am I accepting, but I'm being very specific. Well, I'm being specific, but on the other hand, but no. Isn't that amazing? Because that basically is the same as the yin-yang, isn't it? And feeding and supporting each other. Dancing and playing. one reflecting back the potentiality of the other, which then becomes the other, which then becomes the one, back and forth, back and forth. And always the incredible scintillating energy flow of the universal possibility. Not that it was doomed to happen or it was meant to be. Oh, pardon me. None of that. But the scintillating flow of energy. And so this is called, this card is called, because down here on the bottom is the name of the intelligence this represents. That's Aleph, which means scintillating intelligence. And Aleph also is the letter A in our alphabet. You know, I really need a blackboard to teach tarot. Because I'm always tempted to great drawings. Okay, who's going to lend me their paper and pencil? Oh, thank you. So, you know, our alphabet actually has a long history and is actually a pictogram. Did you know that? Did you know that?
No. I'm not sure. I've heard that before. No.
Yeah. Oh, is this a better pen?
Yeah, black.
Okay. So, for example, A, right? You know A?
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes A, right? So, if you turn it this way, you got, and you're looking at it from above, what have you got? The bull's head. With the horns, right? There's his snout and his pointy nose, right?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Or if you turn it this way, because this could be the same thing, you got a sideways picture of a smaller one. But that's Aleph, and Aleph equals bull. And it's the sign of the beginning of growth. The beginning, before you can actually see it. One of the things that's very interesting about bulls when they're wild is that they go through a field, you know. They got very sharp hooves. Have you noticed that? And in the spring, they will go and dig up the first shoots before they're really emerging, right? Did you know this? And munch them up and eat anything that's coming up. And as they're moving along digging, they're also shitting, right? So there's this nice composting manure being spread, which the seeds from their digestive system are still in. So as they pass, new life happens behind them. The first breath of spring is out. It's also the bull that you use to pull the plow, right? All of our letters are actually pictograms. B, Beth, the half seen and the half unseen of heaven and earth. But see, there's two circles, heaven and earth, but only one side is visible to us. Beth, the mystery. Knowing this, you can begin to feel that. The mystery. Beth means the veil. Isn't that interesting? Every one of our letters, Daleth, the womb between worlds, giving birth to the new, about to give birth. Isn't that interesting? Do you find this interesting or not?
No,
I mean, of course, because I love words and letters, that I'm actually going, oh, guys, did you see this? Oh, far out. Oh, yeah. But I don't know whether this is, you know, maybe you're all accountants. Maybe this doesn't interest you at all. I find this fascinating. That our written words are actually pictograms, like the Egyptian pictograms. And they represent energies. Like a word we say represents an energy. You use this word to say something, people light up. You use this word to say the same thing, but people... Advertisers know that, don't they? Mm-hmm. Don't they?
Mm-hmm. So is it the letters in the word, or is it the meaning of the word then?
Same as in the Buddhist or any of the Buddhist traditions. Every word has a every sound has a vibration, and it has an effect on whatever is around you. It's the same in English. Who knew? Because that teaching gets lost, doesn't it? Thank you. Try to return everything to you so you can still take notes if you want. Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints so far?
So in the sadhana, you've got the pictures that touch some part of your core. So in our letters, do they touch some part of our core when we write them?
Well, they do, but we're not accustomed to looking for that, are we?
But we're not accustomed to it, but I mean on some level?
Yeah, that's why all desire will eventually lead us there. It's just a matter of like, you know, it's the same story in Buddhism. In Buddhism, there is no such thing as evil. There's just people who are taking the slow path. Which I always found quite a bit of a relief, you know. So, but you may be taking the slow path, but it's like, how many times do you want to go on the circle? When you become conscious of that, would you like to, like, you know, get a Harley Davidson and move into the fast lane? Travel light and move faster? it's the question, isn't it? So, how do you do that without creating harm, which slows you down? Because what you're trying to get to is an experience that is called totality, right? Or thou, or Yahweh, or transcendence, or enlightenment. What you're trying to get to is a state beyond desire. Where you're totally conscious, totally present, and not caught in becoming. Because you want satisfaction. You want to come to the state where all desire is satisfied. Period. Don't you? Wouldn't that be nice? Of course, then I often think to myself, what would I do with my hands? But you're not nearly so cynical as I, so of course you wouldn't think that. But it's an interesting idea. Any other questions? Any other questions, answers, comments, complaints so far? There are colors assigned too. Colors also have an energy. Because like any other mystical tradition, the tarot is working with the speech body or the vibration body or the spirit body, whatever you want to call it, the power of desire. We all know that desire is very powerful. We all know that. Most of us have our ways of sort of buying it off by, you know, a little here, a little there, and occasionally going on our binges, don't we? Mm-hmm. And then atoning. Well, we save up secretly for our Cecily, stop. Okay. So to actually figure out how you can make the cycles less peaks and valleys and a little more even, so you might be going slowly uphill and slowly downhill. It's not quite so much of a roller coaster, and so that you have more a sense of seeing the relationship between all parts of the mandala of your life is what any mystical teaching is aimed for. To make it so that the mountains and valleys aren't so terrifying without removing any of the threat that is actually useful. Because there are mountains and there are valleys, but they don't have to be daily. You need to have, in a mystical tradition, you need to have the power to slowly build up your confidence. So when it comes to one of the real mountains, where you really are alone and there really isn't any support, you have the confidence to be interested rather than falling into the, what can I call it? It's such a cheap thrill and falling into the cheap protection of fear, like believing, oh well, what's the use, there's no point, or the cheap protection of faith, oh there must be, you know, that person who told me I had to believe that was right, I should believe it because they told me to. Do you understand? So that hope and fear themselves don't rob you of your right to question. So there is a big mountain. There is a big mountain. And you develop the ability to meet it, because it's only by going through, over to the crest of that mountain, which is has to do with I, that you meet Yahweh, the undergarment that we are all wearing. Because the fool is not separate from every being. The fool is not separate from every being. And the insurance broker in your consciousness stops you from being curious about what the depth desire of your being is, doesn't it? Because you don't really ask yourself when you want something, whether that's really, you don't imagine yourself getting it and saying, and would that satisfy the desire? Do you? We invest all of our hope and all of our fear in the carrot. You know what I'm going to say next? That's on the string, right? That's tied to the stick. That's attached to the head of the donkey. Don't we? Here's the donkey, there's the stick, there's the string, there's the carrot. Don't we? But no, actually just stay where we are. Watch hope and fear. Watch the carrots dance and then take the next step without trying to get the carrot. That's different. And that kind of power that can do that is the power that suddenly comes face to face with the fool. But we work our way up there. We do it by gaining our own confidence, not somebody else's, our own confidence. Of course, that's the hardest of all, isn't it? To let go of all of our stories that we use to give ourselves reason for not having confidence. Oh, in my family, I was the youngest girl of four children, and, you know? Oh, it was so hard, you know? Mm-hmm. Oh, in my family we had everything, and I could never see my because they were and I was. I had to take piano lessons. I couldn't take piano lessons. We have a thousand and one stories about, you know, all of that, don't we? And a thousand and one reasons why our misplaced desire should be something we go for, don't we? The price tag we'd rather pay than to go for what we really want, don't we? Mm-hmm. Thousand little excuses, and a lot of them involve money, don't they? I was going to tell you about Christopher Wren. Do you know who Christopher Wren was? He's a great English architect. Did you know that he made £300 a year? He built, what, more than 40 cathedrals in England, in London? Some of the most famous in the world. He invented how to make arched buildings that didn't need all those columns, right? They refused, which one was it? One of the cathedrals, they refused to put up one of his buildings to pass the plans because it didn't have columns to support it, and they knew the roof would collapse. So you know what he did? He built columns that came this far below the roof, before the ceiling. So from the ground, when you looked up, it looked like they were actually holding them. So the building passed. Where I was reading this, it said, and the columns in the cathedral are still standing today. And that was what, in the 14th century, something like that? 15th century? That's like 600 years. And the columns still aren't touching the roof, the ceiling. And none of them have fallen. Interesting, eh? There's that kind of quality of like being willing to go where you go. Christopher Wren is one of the heroes of art and architecture, isn't he? Today, people are amazed at his design. He basically lived in poverty.
What did he earn a year, did you say?
I think £300 a year. You know, that was nothing for the castles and the cathedrals he built.
Is there some reason for him living in poverty?
I don't know. Probably his ideas were... Yeah. He wasn't the one who was ordering the cathedral. He was the one who was in charge of making a plan for it. You know, he was a servant of the rich, therefore. I mean, his work was admired, but there were a lot of architects. And he was a little suspicious because he was always right on the edge of, and those days. So there's that kind of quality of like actually trusting your own gifts, not feeding your limitations. Very different, aren't they? And that's what the fool knows how to do. Trust your own gifts. And that leaks through in every desire. So if you actually are able to be aware while you're desiring, you will find from that desire the path through to the transcendent. That's what the fool represents. In Eastern philosophy, we would call it the bodhicitta. It is that principle of the transcendent which is present in every consciousness. Every conscious cell, every conscious possibility. So there are many things to talk about specifically about the card. I think it would be I think it would be more useful for me to actually talk briefly about each card. Then if you are interested, you could go and study them more on your own, and we could decide whether we want to do more with it as a group. Does that sound reasonable to you? Mm-hmm. But I think it's important for you to understand that the culture that most of us come from does have a strong mystical tradition. It is easy to miss it because either it's marketed, because our deck of cards actually came from the tarot. It's easily marketed, or it is kind of misrepresented because of at various times of persecution happening in the history of the West, that mystical traditions have been persecuted at various times. Right, so it's easy to have it be misrepresented, but the tarot, as with many of the Western mystery traditions, is a very viable and wonderful meditation path, to use my language for it. And worthy of appreciation. Sometimes when you study more than one way, especially as a Westerner, you start to appreciate your own heritage. So I thought it would be good to introduce this. Because I know I've drummed you with Buddhism of the yin-yang for years now. So, the other thing I'd like to say about the tarot card is, although this is the face of totality, it is about to fall into, over the cliff, into individuality, into separateness. And at every moment, it is about to. This principle never actually falls. When you're talking about totality, wearing more than the cloak of possibility, you're talking about other cards, such as, for example, the Chariot, where that is an aspect of individuality moving towards totality. But here, you're talking about totality about to move into individuality. So therefore, I'm saying to you that there is always this sense of about to fall. With the fool, there is a very profound understanding of the imminence of truth. It's right there, just slightly a millimeter beyond the tip of your tongue, the end of your finger, just vibrating. And in a way, you can never be separate from it. Separateness is what the longing or desire is about, to come back into that union. So, for example, in Masonic tradition, they have the broken pillar, right? Some of you know a little bit about Masonic tradition, which is purportedly what it is that is to be repaired for the new temple, for the rebuilding of the temple. Isn't that true? Well, does that sound anything at all like the broken pillar, like half of the story about to be recreated for the full temple to arise? It's the same symbolism, isn't it? It is, I'll tell you. Or in Judaic tradition, that there is a place for reconnecting with the divine. And the Messiah the path that is going to show the creation is always about to arise. Our whole heritage is based on this understanding belief. All of today's Christianity, if you turn around and actually read it from the eyes of the mysteries, rather than from the eyes of you have to believe this because I can touch it, and God told me this was what would save you. I brought this here, and if you just send me your money, I'll... Or whatever else, maybe the price is actually just faith. Maybe that is like somebody's true belief. I've met many people who have, from their point of view, very strong proof about the reality of something. Whereas when I listen to them, I'm hearing a meditation experience that could get them trapped if they don't look at it from the right angle. Right? Who's right? All of us are right. Because this is totality. Beyond separateness. If the right means there is a wrong, it's not right. None of us are free. What am I going to say? None of us are free if one of us is chained. If one is wrong, it isn't right. Because there will still be that longing. We can drug it, do whatever we want to it, but until we turn around and address that and try to understand what is that really, and be willing to trust our own heart's desire to find our path there, not our way of buying off our heart's desire, but our heart's desire. The fool is the entire story of all creation, falling off a cliff at every moment. Never fall. And always fall. Is that interesting to you? Does that give you a little taste of what you're looking at with tarot? Do you have a question?
No, I was giving a thumbs up.
Oh, thank you.
I like that. I'm going to ask for that. Could I have whether thumbs are up or down for that one? Thank you.
Two for you.
Oh, I never thought of that.
Mm, I wish I had more thumbs.
Hey, for mine, I don't mind. Any questions, answers? It's very interesting, I hope. I found tarot shocking. And then profound, and then bullshit, and then I see this as a path. I remember each of those stages precisely.
Why did you find it bullshit?
Because I was reacting to my sense that this means that everything is understandable. Oh, there's a law for everything. Mm-hmm. And then I went, that can't be true. Also because the people that I was associating with at that time, they always used to do their tarots to see whether they should get up in the morning. Oh. So I had the wrong view of meaning everything. I wasn't understanding it in terms of energy. I was understanding it in terms of who should I vote for. And wasn't it Jesus who said, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's and unto God that which is God's? I think that was the quote, something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's nice to know that, isn't it? Is that still in the Bible? Mm-hmm. Hard to tell by politics today, isn't it? My goodness. And all the good guys that I used to love to hate, but I didn't have to worry about that, they're all disappearing. I'm getting old. Klein? Yeah, King Klein is leaving. You could always depend on him to say something outrageous and then watch the polls and the next day change his mind. I mean, we don't know. I know I'm being over the wall with it, but forgive me, I'll shut up now. I asked you, do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Yes.
When I see that card, it feels as if, I think it was Rinpoche who was attributed to, somebody's asked him about what it's like to be enlightened, and he said, well, act as if, was the phrase. And I've caught myself doing that a couple of times in the last week. I'll be walking along, and all of a sudden I'll catch myself kind of in a negative mind state or something, and I'll just go, just act as if. And I kind of just, it's beyond verbal, but...
Shift.
I shift. And when I see that card, it feels like what I've been doing. Kind of stepping into...
Unknowing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the day just proceeds. But several times a day I've been doing that.
Excellent. It's a beautiful thing to do.
Yeah.
Excellent, Don. Lovely.
The card in
there. I'm sure he would have said that, because one time he was doing a conference in Toronto, and... He was the keynote speaker for a conference that was arranged with a bunch of people with a theme on health and things. And he was the keynote speaker to open the conference. And his last words in his keynote speech, which I just was so beautiful, he looked at us all and he smiled and he said, "Pretend you're awakened." And there was such kindness, it just flowed over everyone with that. It was just like, hey, psst. Yeah. Because some part of that desire is true. So following that is your path. Isn't it? Anyone else?
How can you work with both? Because I find that there's so much in each one, both in the Eastern tradition and the Western tradition.
You're right, there is.
And almost you have to move one up for the other, or can you balance it out?
Well, for myself, was the first time I was introduced to tarot, I hadn't any information in any of them. In fact, I'd never seen a tarot card until I met Ananda Bodhi in 1965. And he intrigued me. And I went to all of his classes and asked a lot of questions. Until at one class, he said, if you're going to keep coming to classes, you have to meditate. So I stopped going to classes.
Pretty straightforward. I wasn't going there. There, but I'm going in there.
And 7 months later, I went to a class, and he said, it's the inner war, you have to stop. And he was right. He was very often right, you know. And then after that class, I went up, and it had been several months, and thousands of people had come and gone in front of him in that time. He looked over the heads of everybody, and he said, "Ah, Cecily." Like, people don't remember my name for 2 days. hundreds of people passed by. So I was that noisy one who kept asking questions and then disappeared for 7 months. I mean, why would he remember me? There's no reason. And he said, "Well, Sonam will give you an appointment. Sonam! Sonam, yes. Come here." He lived in an apartment, I always think the 13th floor, but it could have been the 8th or the 12th floor of this apartment near High Park. Before that, he lived on St. George. Rode the elevator up. Had an appointment in the afternoon. I had managed to get up for that. Big feat in those days. Knocked on the door. It was already ajar. This little voice said, "Come." Pushed the door open. Snuck in. Scared shitless. Didn't know why I was there. Should have gone the other way. He is reading a newspaper. Oh, good, I don't have to see his eyeballs right away. His eyeballs were always like twin suns, you know, they bore right through. Oh, Cecily, yes, come in. Keeps the newspaper up. Okay, I can come in. Where am I going to go? As I'm sort of floundering around, puts the paper down and he says, "Hand me those cards." And he points to the table that sort of, "Hand me those cards." I look around, I don't see any cards. There's some flowers. There's a dish of nuts or something. There's a book. And there's this sort of funny little box. I don't know what's in it. It's got this funny picture on the front and this lots of yellow on it and, you know, sort of some picture on the front, but I don't know, it's obviously not cards. So I'm sort of looking around and he says, "The box." So the cards sort of lit up a little bit.
Oh yeah, pick them.
Took them over to him. He says, sit. Oh, okay, sit. I can do that. And he takes the cards and he shuffles them. And he gives them to me and says, "Shuffle them." I shuffle them. They're falling all over. I pick them up, shuffle them. Takes them back. He puts them down in front of him on the floor in front of me. He makes one cut. He makes another cut. He puts them together, picks up the first card, doesn't even look at it, turns it over, says, "That's you." Takes the next card, makes it the third card, says, "That's me." Takes the next card and puts it in the middle, says, "That's what's going to happen between us." And he says, "Okay, go." That was my first appointment. That was the first time I ever saw tarot.
So, what were the three cards?
That's you was the high priestess, that's me was justice, and that's what's going to happen between us was the nine swords lying down the guy's back and the sun rising in the east.
Cool. Yeah.
I only knew that because they were like emblazoned in my brain. I didn't know what they were, but like years later when I actually studied tarot with them, I began to, and the newspaper had, about 6 months before that, had called me the High Priestess of Pot, so I thought he was joking with that one. Because the Globe and Mail did a 5-part series on me, using me as one of the main resources about different types of drugs and why they should be legalized. Why are we back in this? For my sins. Okay, for my sins. This was part of my past. You see, all desire does, there's proof of it, doesn't it? All desire leads to. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. From marijuana to the monastery, right. I'm only naming the high points, or the low of the high and the high of the low. Or something. Oh, blah, shut up. But so that was my introduction to tarot. And then I never saw it for a while. I had like 2 years of learning how to do insight and the elements, which of course I loved and took to immediately, which is why I insist that you all do them too.
Yes.
So I loved doing them so much. I was such a cooperative student. Not. And then he started teaching tarot again. No, he started that a year later. He started teaching tarot. And I think he was doing it because for most of us who were around at that time, there was a strong desire to understand more about mysticism, and the language of tarot was very open to us because it was closer to our culture. And we also had other teachers. He invited other teachers, a Tibetan teacher who, from whom those notes on the elements that you have came from his classes, Nari Tolku, whose name was. We had a Sayadaw, and we had a Thai monk. We had a Mahayana monk from Hong Kong at various times. We had different teachers come and teach in the first couple of years. Because Ananda Bodhi was also working for part of that time. And then he did this talks on tarot, which were quite extraordinary, really, because that opened a door for us in a Western language. And then from there we went to Buddhist meditation, and then later, probably 15, 20 years later, he started again opening, 15 years later, he started opening the door to the Western schools and the Western mysteries. So I think your question is very important, and I think the answer is, if you get to a certain degree of work with the West, with the Eastern tradition, it's very good for you to go back and look at your roots. Because the real truth about a teaching is, if it's exclusive, you've only got part of the story. It is true that any teaching must be personal, and there are parts of the teaching that I could never explain to you, nor you to me. We cannot actually put a name on truth, but we can point to someone, the window. The words that we use can be the window that allows another to move toward that direction, and maybe from there have a glimpse of truth for themselves. It's their decision to do that or not, not mine. It doesn't negate the value of truth. So whether it's Eastern or Western is, like, really in one way unimportant. Except I find they balanced each other in my experience. That when I had done enough Eastern meditation, then I went back to looking at the Western mysteries, or went back to studying, because at one time my beloved teacher taught Bible. Who knew that? A lot of people have probably forgotten those classes. And to go back, and because it's interesting, because I had been going back and starting to read the New Testament again, and was when I put down all the different copies of it and compared one to the other, you know? That kind of thing. You were talking about that earlier. And then a couple of months later, he started teaching from, I think he started with The New Man. You remember that book, The New Man? Very nice book, Western. It's about, it's based on the Gospels. And then the whole, suddenly my whole background opened up. And so this whole joy of forgiveness for myself and for others. Joy of forgiveness. Because when you know a teaching is valid, you know it's not the letters, the books, they symbolize. They're a window, not what you see through them. And so it isn't that this symbol isn't useful or holy or that devotion to the symbol is out of place. It's not out of place. But to believe that a signpost saying Edmonton, 68 kilometers, is Edmonton, is like, forget it. You're not going to be able to get, you know, you can stop at that signpost saying Edmonton, 68, but you can wait a long time before a Starbucks will appear. You know, I mean, it just ain't going to happen. No, it isn't that that isn't a valid thing, that signpost. It is valid. But it's not going that way, 68 kilometers, or that way, right? So for some people, it's very difficult because they try to find the right answer in a form. They're very Western, science-minded. We have to be able to prove that this is right or it's not worth belief. For those people who understand how powerful belief is, that you keep driving on the same road when it says Edmonton 68 kilometers, it's faith. Not because you know Edmonton's there. Somebody might have turned the sign around. You don't know that. But you have faith that if Edmonton isn't there in 68 kilometers, you can turn around and go back. And then you've learned something about signs. So you have faith that whatever you learn is valid. That you have the right to experience something so that you know whether you want to do it. That's faith. Not in a right answer, but the right to ask a question that will get an answer. But we're so caught up in idealism, aren't we? That we want to know, well, if I do this, will that... If I do this, will it be true in all ways? I know that very often in various schools of meditation or mysticism, you meet people that say, don't mix this up with the other. And don't. Don't mix one teaching up with another. But when you're doing one teaching, and you're really totally involved within it, and then you put it down, then does that mean you can't read the advertisement on the side of your cereal box? If you look at something else, are you mixing it up? But if you check something else because you're interested and it deepens your faith in all things, is that useful? So I think that whole sense is particularly important, not to mix one thing up with another. If someone is sure that there is a right way or that there's an ideal, they don't know the difference between discrimination and judgment. What's the difference, Wade?
Between the two?
Yeah. My Manjushri friend.
Well, I think the discrimination is you're looking at this versus that, where judgment is more of this is it.
This is it. This is right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Discrimination is, well, it's all atoms and molecules, but the way these atoms are formed make them really good to drink, but I don't think I'll drink this. Mm-hmm. This will go on the bookshelf and this won't. Although sometime or other this will not be separate from the bookshelf and neither will this. Knowing that, knowing the essential emptiness of form, nevertheless respecting its use. Right? Discrimination is based on, what is Manjushri holding?
The sword.
And?
The
Prajna Paramita Sutta.
The
Prajna Paramita Sutta.
Yeah.
What is the Prajna Paramita Sutta about?
Form and emptiness.
Interdependence.
Yeah.
Yin yang. Everything is becoming its opposite.
Yeah.
That's the secret of discrimination. No fixed identity, therefore no fixed right. That's the secret of discrimination. The thing that Manjushri does really, really well is get to the point The problem is that Manjushri thinks that that's the right point. And the wonderful thing about Manjushri is they're always ready to say, oh, I guess that wasn't the right point. Because the desire to know more is more strong. The feeling of absolutely being a dogmatic and right, and you know how bullshitty you and I can be. We have the same, you know? We're both Scorpios. Me and Wayne, we're just like that. It's a good thing we live in different cities.
A sword and a stick?
Yeah, both. Yeah, we. You know, if you're going to do it, right, Wayne?
Yeah.
If you're going to do it, you know, don't fuck around. That's what I call it. So we didn't, did we? Although you went one further than me being male and all. I don't know what that's like. It's an extra stinger. I don't know. Well, of course, I'm female. I'm pretty stinging myself. Yeah, okay, shut up. Yeah. That quality of, like, having to be right is basically for our own security, isn't it?
Yeah.
But there is this feeling if we're too right, too dogmatically, it eats our heart, doesn't it? And we can bluff around it for a long time, can't we? But sometime or other, we have to say, Jesus, I'm an asshole, don't we? So that's one of the saving graces of Manjushri, is that there's this, it is the Prajnaparamita. The saving grace of the fool is that it is always dissolving. Always unmanifest. Always potential, never quite falling over the cliff. So when it gets to that point where there is that ability to say something but not believe it, because any form is only a dance of the shadows, of the scintillating energy flow of all possibility. That's when Manjushri is fully manifest, isn't it? And that's when we feel the best, right? So although you can say this is right, and then this is right, and this is right, and this is right, all that's all very interesting, but at some point or other you're going to stub your toe on your own truth. You know that. I know that. Because we have run out of toes, haven't we, in terms of stubbing? You'd think my feet would be getting shorter, but no. So instead of that, that kind of quality of remembering the beauty of the fool, where it's just pure desire. He's holding a white rose. Did you notice that? Well, you didn't. You know it was white because everything in this picture is white, but you have the color edition, don't you, Bob? Could you hold your picture up there? Because I think he's holding a white rose, isn't he?
Yes.
See, in this hand?
Right there, yeah.
He's holding a white rose. So rose is a symbol of the heart's desire, but white is innocence. In this case. It's everything. It could, you know, whatever is present, desire without object, absolute pointed desire without object, like Vajrayogini. So desire without object means without subject. Without desire used for neither subject nor object is transcendent. It's like total desire just to be where you are, nothing missing, right here. No object to soak it all up and, oh, that's the answer, oh, that's the answer. But like a full enthusiasm of heart, regardless of the circumstance. Not bad for a little rose. Yeah, that's in his left hand. And it's very much like the Prajnaparamita. I mean, like Manjushri, isn't it?
Yeah,
yes.
Mm.
The
dog?
Yeah. The D-O-G?
Yes.
The dog is said to represent represent the intelligence, like the Vijnana mind. The mind in Buddhism, Vijnana, the mind that gives names to things, the intellect. But you notice the dog is also white. Picture.
Yes.
Yeah. Turn it around. Like the rose. So that means it can pick up any color, like a mirror. So whatever is present is a desire, like a mirror, or this hand. And the dog is like following behind, not leading or biting on. The dog is following behind the transcendent. So that the aspiration is to find the fulfillment of the real desire. Not to fob it off with the latest fad or drug or whatever. Not to get caught in that. Not to get caught in that. But what is it that is the real desire? What is my path? What is it that I do love? That's what takes you where you gotta go, isn't it? Isn't that what you know from your own lives? When you do what you think you should do, or when you do what you know you need to do, which works better? Which works better? Can't hear you.
What you know.
Is it? Anybody else have anything they want to say about that? Does what you think you should do?
When you do what you should do. When you know what you should do.
When you know. Mm-hmm. When you think you should do something, does that change from moment to moment? Depending on whether you're thinking good about yourself or bad about yourself? Kind of like a fad, isn't it? Oh, I should just give up. I can't do anything right. Oh, I can't do anything. Oh yeah, Oh, you're going there? Oh, I want to go there too. I should, because that's who I should be. But you start doing something and your heart says, very small little voice, right? That's the fool. That's the quality of the fool speaking through your being, speaking through desire, saying, go this way, go this way. Come home, come home. Transcendence is home in all schools. In all schools. We're all going there. Some of us are convoluted in our progress. So the dog represents the intellect following the transcendence rather than trying to satisfy any, get rid of anything that you don't know how to deal with. Rather than buying little side roads hoping it'll all go away.
You say that again?
The dog represents the intellect following the transcendence, reflecting the transcendence, reflecting, following, the memory of all your experiences teaching you that the path to the transcendence is where it's at. Following playfully, yeah, yeah, it's you, it's you. Like Hafiz's poetry, you know who I'm talking about? Oh, that was during your absence. It was when you were staying away. You were teasing me by staying away and I was reading poetry, love poetry, and you didn't even bring Francine. You're such a turkey, your dad. When I most want him, he's not there. I can feel him, but he's not there. Anyway, I'll read you Hafiz sometime. Oh, I'm supposed to say like this. I read you Hafiz. So, So there's this quality of the intellect, like in love with the transcendent, as it's arising in your own being. So that is your guide to follow it, rather than trying to figure out how to get rid of desire by, you know, trying everything. So that the intellect is actually the guide to the transcendent, rather than trying to get away from desire. Try to fob off desire by cheap tricks. Is that all right? Any other questions, answers, comments, or... Oh, you've got 3 minutes left. Then I go on overtime.
When I started reading in the book, the thing that the thought came up was, well, this is very much like looking at a talker. It's the same, you know, there's all these symbols.
Yeah.
And what I found interesting was that the language of the symbolism was kind of foreign to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm going, okay, so why is, I guess I just, either I have taken a totally superficial view of all the Tibetan symbolism, or I've just worked at it so much that it kind of makes sense to me. So that was interesting, and I just go, okay, there's a lot of, there's a lot of depth to this, and it'll be a long process to work through it, and that's cool. But the other thing I started, and that just tonight, I was just kind of contemplating the difference between a society where that's kind of up front,
mm-hmm.
and a society where it's so far in the background you don't even realize it's there.
Exactly.
And and I guess it just, I've always been interested in that kind of history of heresy.
Yes.
You know. And
yeah.
So, but it's just interesting that it's in our background, but it's been driven so down. And then I'm going, well, so if this is an alive tradition, then there should be some people wandering around that really understand it and not noticing it because they're not up front.
Mm-hmm.
Which is,
it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. It's lovely, isn't it, to see
mm-hmm.
that. There isn't any group of human beings in particular that have not understood that there is a path to totality. And every culture in some way or other has found their way of expressing what they have learned about that path or what they have chosen to practice for that path. So to actually respect all the traditions is very valuable. And one of the ways of doing that is to see the richness of a path that is not necessarily the one you have first chosen. And especially if it's one that you have had some contempt for because you didn't understand it when you were a kid. Like Western culture. I mean, a lot of people a lot of the people who are not involved with Reformed Christianity are really afraid of Christianity today. And maybe they need to take another look at it to see what that teaching really is, not your fears about it. Does that make sense? So a lot of people I know, when they say somebody is a Christian, they almost say it like they wish they'd washed their mouth out with soap. Not with the respect that there used to be 20 or 30 years ago. You're afraid you're going to get phone calls, or go on the Mormons hit list. So you have all the students knocking on your door every 2 weeks, Does that only happen in small towns? If you're known as somebody that's really good to go and talk to, because you need to be saved, you get quite a fairly regular visiting.
Yeah. We had our moments for a while.
Yeah. Anyway, 1 minute overtime. who's keeping track.
Final grievance.
How would you work with this card in particular for the, you know, for
draw it.
Draw it.
Take different aspects of this, like chant Allah. Consider bowls.
Bowls?
Bulls.
Bulls.
Is it this one that says that? Oxen or bulls. Since oxen pulled the plow and threshed the grain in primitive husbandry, besides pulling the carts which carried the farmer's produce to market, they became the symbols for the motive power in agriculture. This is another way of saying what I said about the wild bull with the hooves, and, right? Agriculture is the basic form of civilization, thus the ox represents the power at work in all forms of human adaptation and modification of natural conditions, that is to say, all desire. Human adaptation, isn't that done by desire? Mm-hmm. How you make tools, by desire. So I'm saying all desire leads to, right? In all forms of human adaptation and modification of natural conditions. Their use of the word natural there is definitely Paul Foster Case's way of using language. Oxen, again, are symbols of wealth, as our own English adjective, pecuniary, you know, pecuniary, derived from the Latin picus, cattle. So like that, you take a piece and you consider it. Hold it through the day as you're walking around your day. You take another piece. Take the card, get it photocopied, paste it on some cardboard, take the picture of the card, get it photocopied, paste it on some cardboard, color it, do one photocopy, color it a few times. Make a period of time where you sit down and you color it. And when you're doing each color, try to see, okay, each color is a vibration, as each sound is a vibration. Is there a difference when I'm coloring yellow than when I'm coloring? And how many colors of yellow are there? Very good question. So like that, play with it.
The people that sell the book also sell the cards, black and white.
I know, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's worth getting them, or you can make your own. And I also recommend this book because it's close to the way. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get a copy of this. If you're going to get more, I'll have that one. Mm-hmm.
I think the author of that was just died recently.
Uh-huh. Newcastle Publishing Company, is this the same publishing company? No.
You can get it still through Amazon.
Can you? Okay.
Is the book they refer, I think they refer to another one. Is that Paul Casey? Is that what you said? Yeah. That's the one they're referring to, isn't it?
Yeah, because this was the first actually Western first book on tarot written that was in any way comprehensive of the study. And he wrote it, although he was breaking some rules of mystery schools, but he decided to write it because he was working with information mostly that he himself had learned personally. So he felt that he wasn't exactly breaking the laws of mystery.
What are the laws of mystery?
Well, you know, for example, if you're initiated into a temple, one of the things you promise to do is never discuss anything that went on that in that mystery temple outside the temple. So only the people who are at the meeting, because the meeting included everybody who was there, so one person only has one part of the picture. Mm-hmm. Number two, so that's how confusion starts, and it's not all together. And number two, there was a lot of persecution of mysteries in the West. Okay? Mm-hmm. So there was always an oath of secrecy that you promised to join a mystery group. You always promised that you wouldn't repeat anything that was said outside of that group. So all the teaching happened in the group according to the symbols and the ritual and everything, like the Hmong course. Mm-hmm. You know, I give all kinds of classes in here in this room and in other places, halls and places all over the place. where I actually take the symbols of Tibetan tradition and discuss them and make them something that you can understand in your daily life. That's one of the things people like about the way I teach. But the way I do that is very rare, because a lot of people don't do that. Most people either try to dummy down the teaching or make it so esoteric that it's working on the depth mind, but the conscious mind doesn't have a clue. Right? Because you're told not to repeat that teaching that way until you have certain credentials. The credentials are almost impossible to get anymore in our world. So instead of trying to, you know, so some people, you know, give one course, what I try to do is explain the basic parameters upon which one course are Tibetan initiation ceremonies. Explain the basic parameters on which one course rests. Explain to you the power of the symbols so that you can start to understand them. So when you receive a one course, it takes life in you. That's my interest, because I have received many blessings of secret teachings that aren't supposed to be discussed outside of that. And that has borne great fruit for me. And I'm grateful and happy to pass it on, but I can't pass it on by giving exactly as I received it, because I respect the traditional way in which it was passed. But I can pass it on in my own way, and in a lot of ways that's what Case did with this book. So this is really the first one, and this one quotes that one, and other ones quote, most people will quote Case or Arthur Waite. There are quite a few, actually, Western mystic books that actually do break the pattern a little bit and start to introduce you. But some of the newer ones are really very interesting to look at. Way over time now. Oh, God, you guys. Not only my weight in Imros, but in Pearls, too. Hmm?
My favorite book in secret schools is Brotherhood of the Third Degree. It was written in the 1800s, and it's incredible because it has all this symbology in it.
It's a really old book, isn't it?
Yeah, 18 something.
There was a replica of it put out, wasn't there?
Well, I probably have that, but in the front it says 18 something.
Yeah, I think I saw that.
And then it has...
A friend of mine was really into it.
Right. It has a symbol on the front, and somebody saw it one time and said, well, that's the Masonic symbol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Masons is one of the long-standing traditions that really has maintained the Western secrets. They've been going through a bit of a dilemma of late, but I think it's very interesting. They're actually growing again. Actually finding young membership is starting to be interested in them again. But because of their strong secrecy, I think they were sort of thought to be a society of old codgers, not a society of profound mysticism. Mm-hmm. And some of the people that are Masons probably aren't profound mystics. La-di-da. Some of the people are in priests aren't exactly profound searchers either. Some of the people that are Buddhists aren't exactly profound testers of faith either, are they? Because the primary law of Buddhism is to see for oneself, isn't it? Isn't that the primary law of Buddhism? To be seen for oneself. For example, I can see for myself, it's time we quit. You notice this extremely beautiful gold light in your eyes. We're not supposed to do this, but we're going to. Because it's a Western mystery name. Mm. But I like doing it. With others. The gold light spreads through your body, down your arms, tingles down your fingers, down your toes, your legs to your toes, of course. Moves up your spine, through your head, goes tickling up through your head and out the molecules that all your hair is going, gold light. Your skin is abuzz with it. Fills the room. Moves through the house. The cat's just got it. Neighborhood. Edmonton. Anyone you want to pray for, they're washed with the light. Alberta. Canada. World space. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered. By our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there's less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.